Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 336th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and on this most somber June 19th, or Juneteenth, I am privileged to be joined by a Black writer, producer, and actor who has made race and class in America central subjects of many of the shows that he has created, en route to becoming one of the most important and admired voices in television today. The 2019 recipient of the Producers Guild of America's Visionary Award, he made his name with Black-ish, a comedy series which was inspired by his own family, which has run on ABC since 2014, which received a Peabody Award in 2015, and for which he received Best Comedy Series Emmy nominations in 2016, 2017, and 2018. The New York Times has called the show, quote, one of the funniest and most daring network sitcoms of the 2010s, close quote. He also presided over two Black-ish spinoffs, Grown-ish, which has run on Freeform since 2018, and Mixed-ish, which has run on ABC since 2019. And in April, he unveiled Black AF, a controversial comedy series in which he plays a heightened version of himself, think Curb Your Enthusiasm and Louie, which is also his first major project for Netflix, since he and the streamer signed a three-year, $100 million deal with an option for two additional years back in 2018. I'm talking, of course, about Kenya Barris. Over the course of our conversation, the 45-year-old and I discussed, in addition to the current moment of reckoning across America, the childhood traumas that shaped the man he is today, his struggles and frustrations in TV writers' rooms in the years preceding Black-ish, what, despite Black-ish's immense success and cultural impact, which prompted some to describe him as a modern-day Norman Lear, led him to ask to be let out of his contract with ABC and head over to Netflix, and what he has made of the divided response to his work since he got there, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Kenya, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and great to have you. Before we do what we normally do, which is bug our guests about their whole life story, I want to just kind of ask if I can, I want to ask how you're doing and where your thinking is at the moment in light of the fact that, you know, we're living through some pretty strange times between coronavirus and then, of course, the aftermath of Mr. Floyd's killing. I know that you probably more than most have pondered and written about race and things related to it and police brutality. So I think a lot of people would like to know your general take at the moment.
I think, you know, it's interesting. I'm in the process of and in talks with Netflix. Pharrell and I sold a, and I think Juneteenth being around this time is a big deal. Like, that was a big deal for Black-ish. It was one of the things I said in my life that if I was ever able to do to make that a national holiday. Pharrell actually just got the governor of Virginia to announce it as the second state in the union to get a paid state holiday. I'm emailing back and forth and talking to Gavin Newsom's office to try. I wrote California to follow suit. You know, and corporations around the world are doing amazing things. I just spoke to you offline. Reed Hastings just donated $120 million to HBCUs, which is the biggest donation. So, I mean, I think corporations are doing the right thing. But for me, it is, you know, I think the notion of having been blessed and lucky enough to be writing about these things and talking about them and to, you know, to America and not just Black America, but America, and doing it in a way that I feel like, you know, often have been considered white-splaining and things like that, which I never really felt like it was like that. I think that it was sort of pulling the curtain back and giving context to Blacks as well, you know, saying my community as well, things that we were feeling and talking and putting them into words, into actions through gifted actors, and doing the same thing with Black AF. I feel like it was, you know, a big thing. But this moment in particular, the reason that, you know, we decided we're going to, you know, Pharrell and I are going to do a musical. We sold it first to Oscar Eustace at the Public, and now we're going to do it as a, you know, with Jordan Cooper at Netflix as a film. This moment in particular, reason we got into that, like we have to do this now, is because, you know, the karmic irony of the notion that Colin Kaepernick was fired from his job for kneeling for the specific cause of police brutality, not racial equality, not equal pay, not, you know, this, that, but police brutality was, you know, basically blackballed from his job. And that now we have a young man losing his life, you know, in a tragic public way. And he's become the global symbol for this movement because a police officer brutalized him and snatched his life away by kneeling on his neck. You know, I think that we say coincidence as because human beings, we don't know how to explain things we don't not explain. Although coincidence has been proven to be mathematically impossible, you know, this is not happening by chance. You know, these things, it's time. I think, you know, it's the moment that I've seen the most unified culturally movement since probably the 60s, which would not have happened with, you know, would not have been possible without white liberals walking alongside, you know, black civil rights protesters. You know what I'm saying? We came together. And I think that now I've seen signs that, like, and it's not a white or black thing, but I've seen funny signs that, like, even white people are sick of white people's stuff. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, we're seeing the Karens and this and that. It's not a black-white thing. It really isn't. It's not a rich-poor thing. It's not a left-right thing. It's monsters against humanity. You know what I'm saying? And I think that we're all starting to see that we all have a right to our own humanity, you know, and our own civility and our own being. And I think that we're coming together in a way that I haven't seen. So there's some beauty that comes out of this ugliness.
And just, you know, in terms of how you are personally feeling and you're dealing with your own family, in terms of having these conversations, which, you know, we see the simulated sort of fictional versions of those conversations in your work. But how do you talk to your kids, six kids, about what's going on?
You know, it's interesting. My girls, who are 21, 18, and 14, have been unbelievably activated. You know, my daughter was actually detained by police on Friday night when it happened. My 18-year-old, who just came home from NYU, was involved in, like, a rubber bullet incident and seeing police cars set on fire. It really shook her up, and she was out there protesting. And my 14-year-old started a group called Black Kids Who Care, Lola. And, you know, she started with some, you know, she's one of those, you know, quote unquote entitled kids or whatever. But, and I didn't know that this was in her, but she got with a bunch of other kids and they started a group, and overnight had thousands of followers. And it's really well done and really well executed. And I didn't even want the parents to really sort of mess with it too much because they really started something and it's their world. And I was torn because I was like, I don't want my kids to get hurt. I don't want my kid, you know, but my kids' lives don't mean more than anyone else's kids' lives. And it's their future they're fighting for. And they grew up with me as a dad and hearing me say what I'm saying. So this is how change happens. You know, we've heard it before, but the American Revolution was a violent protest. You know what I'm saying? And there's no version of that that has, of any movement that's ever happened, that really did not have some form of this. So it's scary times. And with, you know, I saw a meme who thought that COVID would lose a 48-3 lead to racism. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's interesting, though, isn't it, that, you know, a part of me wonders if it was necessary for COVID to be there to cause people to stop long enough to really think about things that we've been seeing for years but haven't mobilized against. Maybe I wonder if this moment would have been possible without the COVID break.
That's the thing where I say coincidence is mathematically impossible.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people were home. People were out of work. People were home. People were frustrated. People were scared, you know, and it was the sequence of events that led to this being able to happen globally, you know, and being able to get the response and the unification globally. And I feel like sometime, you know, things that we don't see are, you know, setting us up for things that will come, you know. So I agree with that completely. I think that the timing was less than appropriate, you know what I'm saying, or less than, you know, what we would like it to be, but at the same time, the perfect timing for it. So it's been, you know, I have all the 2020 jokes that everyone else has, you know what I'm saying. I'm waiting for the aliens like everyone else. But, you know, it's the age of Aquarius. It's, you know, rising from a phoenix. You know, I think that sometime, you know, this is, if you went back and look at great change throughout history, there were moments like this that seemed to be a lot of things compounding, aggregating into what may hopefully be, you know, a moment of change.
Absolutely. Well, all right. Now I'm going to do our traditional start, which is to just ask you. So for folks who may not know, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Pacoima, California, moved to Inglewood, and my dad worked at General Motors in Van Nuys, California. He was an assembly line guy, and my mom was kind of a do whatever she needs to do, you know, stay at home mom / real estate broker / insurance agent / works at department stores during the holidays / whatever she had to do, yeah, you know, to sort of help it pitch in.
And they parted ways when you were quite young, right?
Yeah. Before I was 10, I think it was done before that, but yeah. I think they were officially done by the time I was like 9 or 10.
So do you know why they gave you the name Kenya?
I do. My dad was was in the Nation of Islam, and he was, you know, like at that moment, he was in the Nation of Islam doing quote symbols, because it was more so of like, you know, being a black NRA member at that time. But well, you know, he was a revolutionary.
It's like when
he was a revolutionary.
You have, what do you say on Blackish? It's black Bobcats. They were adjacent.
He was a Bobcat. Their uniforms were much more conducive with the California lifestyle. He's, you know, recently passed away, but he was a very interesting guy. But he, you know, wanted to have a kid whose name felt, you know, Afrocentric, and was a, you know, it's interesting because I did a whole episode about this, and it was something that I find out so many things like the Laquandas and Tatianas and Sequinicas and all that. That was an attempt, and people often make fun of those names, I being one of them. But what I actually found out was that was an attempt during a time when you know, blacks were looking for a nationalist sort of point of view for themselves, to say, we're not a part of Africa. You know what I'm saying? That part of our culture has been taken, but we're also not a part of necessarily a fully accepted part of this community. How do we form things that feel like they are part of what, you know, African-American nationalism, you know, in this country is? And those names, when I started hearing that, I was like, I would never make fun of another one of those names, because it was a direct attempt at trying to liberate, you know, and trying to find a sense of self within a place that, by the nature of Jim Crow itself, was not really meant for us to have a sense of self. So I, you know, those moments like Juneteenth for me even was like, I used to like, you know, Juneteenth, ha ha. But then I realized that as much as I love hot dogs and fireworks, how could July 4th of 1776 be Independence Day when everyone wasn't free? You know, and it took me sort of getting behind the curtain, pulling that back, and actually explaining what my revelatory moment was to the world in my writing. And that was something I was really happy that show allowed me to do. And I tried to do the same thing in Black AF.
So only because, A, you've spoken a lot about this before, and B, because I can't imagine it didn't majorly shape the person who you are today, I want to ask you, I mean, you've said there was quite a bit of trauma, is the word you've used, within your childhood, starting mm-hmm. very young. I mean, stuff that, you know, losing a brother at a younger brother mm-hmm. at a young age, experiencing physical abuse from your, I believe, your father. And then the most kind of mind-blowing for me to think about is when, I guess, at about 6, you know, you see your father kind of come mm-hmm. in without being invited, and your mom shot him. And that was something that he survived. But I mean, that's got to have a big effect on a kid, especially at that young of an age. So I hope it's not too personal a question, but I'm just curious how you think they impacted the person that you are.
I mean, because therapy and, you know, and sort of like actual like interpersonal dealings with our emotions is not really a big part of our community, because as a community, we've just been taught sort of, you go on, you know what I'm saying? Go to church, go take a bath, go take a nap. You know what I'm saying? You go on because I really, for the longest, and wasn't until very recently, felt like it didn't have an effect on me. You know, I felt like it was just, you know, part of what it was, because I knew so many other people who had, maybe not those specific things, but other, you know, it's generational trauma. You know what I'm saying? It's generational trauma that goes back and back and back. And sometimes they become mere stripes. You know what I'm saying? So until very recently, when I actually had some financial moments in my life that gave me a little bit of time to introspect in a different way, I did not think that they had an effect on me. And just to clear this so I'm clear, my dad never physically abused me. He was physically abusive to my mom. And so it wasn't, you know, it was more of a thing with him. But, you know, I did not think that those things had an effect on me. You know, I felt like, you know, it's just you do what you do and, you keep it moving. But I, you know, in recent times, I've seen that it's had an effect on a lot of things for my marriage. You know, I'm saying that, you know, we're going through a divorce and we're seeing where things, we went through things to my interpersonal dealings. But I also felt like in some aspects it gave me, there's a lot of beauty that comes from tragedy sometimes, you know, and comedy in particular is an offshoot of tragedy. And, you know, I think we saw that in Dave Chappelle, you know, and brilliant as he is, as a comedian can be, you know, went and probably said four jokes, you know what I'm saying? But it wasn't about that. It was seeing that a person who really knows how to metabolize, you know, and thusly reverbalize that what comes out of his body into something that is a moment. We saw it with Richard Pryor. Like it was one of the most powerful moments that I've seen, you know, during this whole thing. And I felt like that's sort of what we're taught, you know, any sort of marginalized group or group who's going through, you know, things and you're kind of, you just have to keep going. You take that and you take your lemons and make lemonade. And I feel like it has definitely formed and been a part of my comedy.
So for people who grew up with you that, you know, maybe we didn't know that these things were going on, but they just were your friend. How would they remember the kid, Kenya Barris? Were you writing a lot and doing things like that even then? Were you consuming a lot of television or other things like that? I mean, I'm curious
TV was my babysitter. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? My mom worked a lot. You know what I'm saying? TV was my babysitter. Inappropriate television, you know what I'm saying? Wasn't as inappropriate as it could be now, but like, you know, I remember watching SNL. You know, I remember seeing, you know, Raw. I remember seeing old tapes of Live in Concert. I mean, remember listening to That Nigga's Crazy. And I remember, you know, but at the same time, I'd listen to Bob Newhart's Button Down Mine. I'd listen to Carlin. I'd listen to whatever. But, I, you know, Saturday Night Live was a thing I was staying. I was way up way too late, watching it way too early. But I got it. I started getting it at an early age, and it became my sedative. You know what I'm saying? It was my opiate, and it really got me through. And you know, I also was a big comic book head. You know, I read all the, you know, I was a Marvel guy, but you know what I'm saying? And so when all those movies started coming out, I was most excited for X-Men, which I really feel like Fox started off well and just let it go down. I feel like, how did Avengers beat X-Men? X-Men was so much more exciting. But, you know, I was definitely a part of that. I also was a kid who, I had asthma at a young age, so I wasn't in outside as much as I, you know, should have been. But once I got out, I really fucking got out, you know.
You're a good athlete in middle school, right?
I was a good athlete. I was also in and out the streets, you know what I'm saying? I kind of had that, you know, caged animal out, you know, and but my mom had seen my brothers, you know, in and out of trouble and was made sure that my path was going to be a little bit different. I butted heads against her, but she pushed hard.
You know, another thing, people tend to ask you, you know, that they look at your work and they talk about race first, but there's class. I mean, class is as much a conversation, yeah, there, I think. And for you guys, there was a very, it's fascinating reading about you to learn that there was sort of a before and after moment, and it again involves your dad. I wonder if you can share just what, I'm sure it surprised him as much as anybody, but
I was like, did you set this up? No, my dad was a boiler operator at assembly line and boiler operator at General Motors, and that's the guy who sort of, he was in charge for like mixing the chemical that makes the paint stick to the cars, you know what I'm saying? Makes it. And you know, a truck was coming in and he was back, you know, told her to back in, and whatever was labeled on the outside of the truck was not what was actually inside the truck. It had been misfilled. He put it in, a big, you know, toxic cloud came up. It was well documented at Van Nuys. A lot of people died. He lost a lung. We got a considerable settlement, especially for us. I mean, now it wouldn't be, but at that time it was a considerable settlement. He and my mom had been married for 20 years, so she got half of it. He was not happy about that. And my mom, you know, took what she could, and you know what I'm saying, and you know, whatever parts we got. And my mom was also very industrious and, you know, self-starter, and she went and started a life different for us than we would have necessarily been the original plight.
And for people in the LA area, just to think about it in their own minds, I guess it was going from Englewood to Hancock Park. That's a big move and
Hancock Park adjacent. Yeah, but that's going ashy to classy, as Biggie would say. You know what I'm saying? In some aspects, but I I really attribute a lot of that to my mom. You know, being really high on education and high on us having. I think that we were the first generation, mid 40s, we were the first generation to have really benefit from the civil rights movement. Like for us, it was no longer like I want to go to class. It was like you have to go to school. You know what I'm saying? This is why we marched. This is why we did that. So it was, you know, my brothers and sisters went to USC. You know, it was like you have to. It was not an option. So my mom really made sure that education was going to be a big part of our lives. And I think that is a key to changing anyone's place.
And so you go off to Clark Atlanta University. I know you ended up with a degree in radio, TV, and film. When you graduated and headed back to LA, at that moment, what did you imagine the rest of your life professionally and maybe personally, but what did you think it was going to look like?
Not like this. not like this. Tyra was my best friend. We called ourselves cousins, so we grew up since we were babies.
This is Tyra Banks.
Yeah, Tyra Banks. And you know, I moved in with her. She was actually living in a Hollywood Hills, you know, pretty nice house. You know what I'm saying? And we moved in. So it was a little bit not surrealistic for me. But, you know, we were young. We had our falling outs. And she kicked me out the house one day. And I had to go do it. But I didn't know what I was going to do. I actually thought I might get into politics. I was working for city council for this councilman, Nate Holden. My mom had, you know, knew him and got me the job. And, they had wanted me to start talking about low-level, running for a low-level office and things like that. So I thought that might be a thing. I did publicity for a while. I did music publishing for a while. But it was... I always knew that I wanted to do something with comedy. I always really, really enjoyed writing. A lady, Felicia Henderson, got me a job on Sister, Sister, Sister. Steve Stark helped me get into the Paramount Comedy Writers Program for short lasted, but, you know, got it. I got a taste of it, and I knew that that was... I wanted to be a director maybe when I was in college because I was Dr. Eaglethorpe, who was Spike Lee's mentor, you know what I'm saying? Eichelberg, but became mine. But... I knew that directing, you needed money to put up and writing, all I needed was a laptop, you know, and being a PA on a show, I was on Sister, Sister, one day the budget came across my desk and I I tell every PA, look at everything that comes your way, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I looked at the budget and I saw the writer's thing and I was like, I took a pencil out and I was like, this guy is going to make this week more than I'm going to make this entire year. With taking extra mileage and taking home waters home or whatever the case may be. And I was like, this is what I want. So that was sort of my way. And I felt like with television, you really get to be more of the boss as the writer. Or in film, you know, saying you're kind of little bit more of a tool. So, you know, it was a good entry point into that place for me.
I had read, I think it was in a New Yorker profile of you, a little bit about how you came to know Felicia D. Henderson, who I think at the time was writing for Moesha, and you just mentioned the Paramount Writers Program, which was sort of the way it was described in that article was that it was a diversity initiative. Can you talk about, the way you came to meet Felicia Henderson was out of a little bit of frustration at the landscape of TV, right?
Yeah, we were doing, I think it was called Black Noir or something like that, but it was about the notion of what was becoming almost starting to be viewed by mainstream, once again, quote signs being used, writers, as like a Chitlin Circuit sort of, right? You know what I'm saying? Thing, you know, you had that uptick of netlets, that was the UPN, the WBs, the things like that were coming about, and they knew that they needed eyes, you know, and because black people would show up and support each other, they were putting on black shows. And so you had these black shows that were coming on, but the plan, and Felicia ended up, who's a great academic, she ended up writing a thesis on this, is that this was the plan that they used. Fox was doing the same thing. They would, you know, get these put these African-American shows on, get eyes to them, seemingly creating showrunners, right? Seemingly. And creating, you know, careers. And they did give a lot of people opportunities. But then once they started getting enough eyes and they got advertisers to sort of say they have enough eyes to get ad dollars, they slowly would start moving in a Dawson's Creek. They slowly would start moving in a Married with Children. They saw, you know, the idea they would push us out, you know, because now they had eyes. And it was a systematic formulated way of, once again, building something up on the backs of Black labor, you know what I'm saying, and of our sort of place, our gift to this country, which was at that time was comedy, you know what I'm saying, and sort of that comedic voice. And then once we got there, they'd move us out. You know, there now, to be fair, there are quite a few voices that still remain from there, but a lot faded away because it was, you know, the notions and the rhythms and the how sort of quote unquote mainstream comedy was written and produced. Those weren't the same rhythms that we, you know, we were writing under. And so they would not, you know, they would put us in rooms with when mainstream shows would happen. They'd say, well, you don't necessarily get how this goes. Or they'd make us diversity writers, which became an initiative. And I was a diversity writer. And it was the worst moment you ever could have in a situation where someone looks at you and they feel like you don't really deserve to be there. And they're just waiting for your year to be up. And, you know, and then when you try to go get recommendations, they shit on you, you know, so it was a really difficult thing to do.
And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that when you originally envisioned Black-ish, which there's a lot in between those moments, which I'm going to ask you about, but I mean, wasn't it originally set as a writer who was,
yeah,
I think I'd read something about being maybe a diversity hire for a TV writer's room.
That's exactly right. It was literally true, 100% my story. You know what I'm saying? Where mm-hmm. I had, there's a moment in the Black-ish pilot when they asked, like, Trey, how would a Black guy say good morning? You know what I'm saying? And that question absolutely was asked to me, like 100%. And it sounds like I couldn't write. And I was like, I'm probably pretty much like that. But like, you know, let me check in at the next meeting and just make sure there's
changes.
Yeah. But like that question was absolutely asked to me. And it's asked without malice, you know, and I saw it then as being asked without malice. I see it now with some success a little bit differently. I felt like it might be asked, although maybe not without malice, without a lot of care, you know. And I think that is one of the things that we're seeing now in terms of what's happening is that people are saying, like, I didn't mean anything by it, but I didn't take a lot of time to think it through. You know what I'm saying? And although that's not malice, it's the cousin of malice, you know, because the effect often is the same.
And I guess that this was a consistent frustration for the years that you were a writer on TV prior to Black-ish coming along or before you created Black-ish. Because Felicia Henderson, so you interviewed her for that documentary, it looks like around 1998. Black-ish was sold in 2013. So there's 15 years there where you're making your name in TV as a writer. I know that with Felicia, I don't know if it was your first writing job on TV, but you go to work then having met her, you go to work for her on the only Black family drama on TV at that time, which was Soul Food, and that's in 2000. And then there were a lot of different things along the way where you're in a writer's room and then I guess on the side writing your own pilots that you're hoping will get a life, you know, get be given an mm-hmm. opportunity. Can you talk about the grind of that time? Like when you're in those writers' rooms, how does one stand out in terms of getting the chance to hopefully move up on the food chain? Were you finding that there in those days you were truly the only person of color in a room? And then what was happening with your own work? These 18 pilots that you wrote before Black-ish that just didn't end up on the air.
It was interesting because sometimes, you know, like if you were working for a Black showrunner, oftentimes they would be much more mindful of the staff. So it would be a, you know, integrated staff, but there still weren't a lot of Black writers. So it was really, I don't think I ever worked for an all Black staff. You know what I'm saying? I think that it was still very, you know, integrated, but it was more. But then there was times when you'd be on a white show, and I definitely had been the only Black writer on a couple of those versions. I think that the notion that I constantly sort of for myself, and I do think that in some aspects it might have had something to do with some parts to do with, you know, me having some of the success that I've had, is that I knew that it was really important for me to sell a pilot every year, you know, in a different way than just I wanted to sell a pilot. I wanted to make sure that you weren't going to marginalize me and say I'm just on this Black show, that the executives at the network, at the studio, you know, we're going to hear my name. We're going to see me come pitch. We're going to actually see me as a salesman. We're going to see the things that I could create and do on my own outside of these shows that I think that they were marginalized. I worked on a show called The Game, and it moved from CW to BET, and when it did, it broke cable records, like shattered them. And I remember going into staffing meetings and network staffing meetings with executives, and they were like, "What show are you on?" And I'm like, "I'm The Game," and I kind of said it proudly the first couple of times, and they were like, "Excuse me, what show is that?" And I'm like, "You know, the show that just broke every cable record ever, you know." And it was, I'm like, "This is your job, you know, to know these things." And if it had been, you know, Girls, which got, you know, marginally, you know, was a great show, but did not get, you know, got 600,000 people a week watching it, you would know that show, you know. But here's a show that shattered black, white, all the things. People didn't know that show. So it was, I started seeing those moments. And I started realizing, you know, I had a really, really good friend who's still my good friend. But, you know, we were talking about the ratings on The Game. And he said, "Yeah, but those are all black people watching, right?" And he didn't mean it fucked up at all. You know, he's my boy. He meant it probably the way that's how people were looking at it. And I'm like, "Yeah, those might be a lot of black people watching. But they spend this. They spend money. Those are eyes. Those are this." But it was, I understood that that was how it was being looked at. So it was really important to me every year to sell a pilot, to be in those conversations, to keep being, you know, every year I'm here again, guys, a solo pilot, to let it get to different levels of whether it be, you know, getting shot, getting close to getting picked up, getting, you know, I kept it going. And it also became, you know, I had a family really young. My wife was in medical school. It also became like a necessary part of my income. You know, It wasn't just like selling pilots because I wanted to. I needed that X amount of money, you know what I'm saying? And I was really, really also interested in, you know, every year you sell a pilot, you get a little bit more, you know, it's like building up a contract and you're trying to build up to a number where you have some respect. It's a respectable number. And I understood that game and playing that game, and it became something that was really educational for me.
Do you think, looking back, you know, if you can be as objective as possible, were any of those pilots that didn't get picked up, or I know a few of them got even as far as being produced, I think three of them, but they didn't go on the air. Were any of them on a par in your own mind with what you eventually did with Black-ish?
Yes. Yes.
So that must have been a frustration.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a few stick out. A few were actually done over in a different way by other people. And I'm like, that was my show. I think that Black-ish was special though. I think because it was, even though the shows, other shows, I feel like might have been a part in terms of my writing, it was, Black-ish was very personal. It was the moment that I stopped. I kind of had my fuck it moment. And I was like, I'm not going to try and appeal to anyone else. I'm going to tell my story that actually, I'm not going to pull any punches. And I felt like I knew my story best. And you learn as a young writer, most of those first things that you do are your stories. You know what I'm saying? Whether you're putting yourself on a, you know, on a ranch or on a, you know, a space camp, you know what I'm saying? You're basically telling a version of your story. And I decided to really tell my story and not worry about, you know, what happens. I just was telling someone yesterday, like there's never in the history of television been a pilot that's picked up because you took every note. You know what I'm saying? They've never said, you know what, God, this pilot really isn't good, but he took every note, so we're going to pick it up. Right. And so with that being said and knowing that, I tell young writers, like, be respectful of the process, be collaborative, be someone that they want to work with, but also understand, be true to your vision. Because whether it's when it goes or doesn't go, at least you can say, I kind of stuck to my guns.
So Black-ish, when the pilot was put out there, became, a big focus of a bidding war between a lot of different places. And I think in your mind, you were originally thinking it would be good for FX, right? Why did it then end up at ABC, a network, which comes with its whole different set of constrictions and requirements that obviously would be an issue in some ways later? But why, how did it end up at ABC instead?
Well, I love Landgraf. I still to this day love Landgraf. I think he's a genius. I think he's one of the best network executives going in terms of like really taking chances and letting creators be creators. I also knew that there was a scope to what he did. You know what I'm saying? And I felt like in order for this to really, really make the dent that I wanted it to make and open the doors that I wanted to open, which a lot of those moments I learned from seeing what Shonda had done with her shows, because she opened so many doors for so many of us. I wanted to make sure that the scope and the broadband capability of where I was going was enough to really actually hit a real number, you know what I'm saying? And be a show that people said, oh, And then, you know, Paul, who bought, who was the president, Paul Lee, who was the president at ABC, the way he courted the show, you know, was amazing. You know, we were very close to going to NBC because Lawrence Fishburne, who was the reason the show was picked up, was doing a show, I think Hannibal, at NBC. They had a good relationship there. But the way Paul Lee courted the show and what ABC had been doing with family sitcom for a while was really interesting. And I had this dream. I was like, wow, what if we could come on after Modern Family? Like, what if that was the opportunity? And that happened. We got scheduled after Modern Family, and it only happened, I think, one time. But I remember making a bet with the studios that our original number, our premiere number, I was like, it's going to beat Modern Family. And it never happened again. But it did. You know what I'm saying? I think the aggregate number, because it was, you know, Black people show up for each other. And because we're on that network, a lot of other people showed up for us as well.
It's just interesting I didn't know this, and I think people might find it interesting. Most of the time, about more than 3/4 of your audience of Blackish was white, right?
Yep, absolutely. And we would get, I think a lot of, you know, we did not start off the first season like that, you know, but shortly into the first season, the juggernaut of Empire came up. And I think it was a scheduling snafu. And I fought against it. You know what I'm saying? I remember calling everybody and making the calls like, please don't do this. They took us off because Fox was doing baseball, you know, and they didn't want to put this. So they took us off and they scheduled us back on like 3 weeks after baseball had went off. But during that 3 weeks, Empire came on. And Empire, we had not seen, I still don't think to this day, to network television, a show that grew every week for like 7 weeks straight. Monster numbers. It was like monster number, monster number, monster. Like, it was like we had not seen that. And what happened is there's only, you know, so much, you know, if it's a movie, you say there's only so much box office. You know what I'm saying? There's only, so, you know, Empire at one point, I heard a crazy stat that 25% of African Americans in the country at one point were watching it live. You know what I'm saying? Wow. That it was, because there's not that many of us, you know what I'm saying, here. Yeah. And that, like, a quarter where, you know, at some point we're tuned in, it was a juggernaut, you know what I'm saying? And so a lot of our Black viewers, we lost during that period, and we never got them back. We did get them back in SVOD, and things like that online, but we lost them. So, you know, a lot of our audience, our overnight audience, was, you know, a portion of the Modern Family audience. And that was, you know, something that was a blessing and a curse. In some aspects, people have felt like, well, that's not a real, you know what I'm saying, Black show or whatever. But then people like, you know, organizations, which I always have my heart to, like the NAACP, we swept, and we've swept 6 years straight. And I don't think a show has ever done that. And we were just honored by our community in a way that I could not imagine. And then we started to get, you know, Golden Globe nominations and Emmy nominations. And we won a Peabody, we won an AFI, Tracy won the Golden Globe, we won... You know, we won basically all the awards except an Emmy.
Well, I guess, though, it begs the question, because you mentioned that, you know, coming up as a writer, some of these shows were clearly in your mind, and I think in a lot of other people's, all right, this is a Black show, this is a white show. In your mind, when you're writing Blackish, who was your audience that you were imagining?
I wrote it for... I'm going to give you the honest answer.
Yeah.
I wrote it for my people, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. for my community. Mm-hmm. But I wanted everybody to watch it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I'm a populist, and I don't run from the notion that, you know, in order for us to really make change, you know what I'm saying, we need big box office. And the only way that you get big box office is that you have a multicultural, vast group that sort of samples your programmer. But I feel like, and the thing that I've learned, music was a really big part of this, you know what I'm saying? But also we learn as writers in telling our stories, the specific speaks to the universal, you know, but like you can look at music. I knew kids from Idaho who had never seen a Crip before, and they heard Snoop and saw Snoop. They're like, I don't know what a Crip looks like or sounds like, but this guy seems real, you know? And so I think that there was a honesty and a specificity of the Blackish that spoke to a lot of different people, and that really helped to open up that world in a different way.
So when it went on the air, after a few things that now seem kind of laughable, I don't know if they were funny to you at the time, but I heard they'd at one point asked you to call it the Johnsons or Urban Family, stuff like this, just like crazy, crazy stuff. And obviously changing the setting from a TV writer's room to what it became at an advertising agency. I guess prior to all the success, which started pretty quickly with Black-ish once it was on the air, if your career, let's say that had not been ordered to series and you were back to where you were before Black-ish, could you have been happy and content, and or did you feel like in your career you were not realizing your potential? You were not fully, you know, you were not as successful as you'd want it to be prior to Black-ish. How basically, let's imagine a universe where it didn't happen.
I've never been asked that question. I was becoming really frustrated. You know, I felt like I was getting in rooms with showrunners that I didn't think were, I mean, if I'm going to be honest, I didn't think they were talented. I was working on projects with people that I felt like were, you know, seemingly doing much better than me, that didn't have, you know, a tenth of the talent that I had. I saw a lot of, you know, my friends, you know, really good friends of mine, Alex Barno and Mark Farrick, sold Mr. Sunshine. And it was a big show with Matthew Perry, and I came and worked on it, and they couldn't hire me. They said the studio didn't approve me to get hired. And I was like, I was getting really frustrated. So if I'm being honest, I don't know what I would have done. You know what I'm saying? I don't know that I would have continued, you know, especially having a family, and maybe I would have just, you know, staffed and been happy being staffing. The television landscape changed. There were less opportunities on quote unquote Black shows. I wasn't getting the look on mainstream shows. I don't know, you know, I'm a hustler, so I would have figured something out, but I don't know that what my life would have been, honestly.
Did it give you any sort of a cushion? Because I know I've glossed over this accidentally, but I mean, you mentioned Tyra Banks earlier, and then I think an early thing in your career was that you and she sold America's Next Top Model, which became a big thing. This was early 2000s. Did that at least take some pressure off you financially, or do you go through that pretty quickly when you've got six kids?
No, it took some pressure off me. You know what I'm saying? It gave me the power of no, which I think also helped to really change my career, because I started being able to say no to, you know, opportunities that might have been, you know, for a lot of Black writers, been like, oh my God, I was able to kind of say no and be a little bit more conscious. I mean, I could have lived off of it. You know what I'm saying? It wouldn't have been fulfilling, and I might have went back to Top Model. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Had I, you know, and really maybe went the reality route, or maybe went into politics in some aspects. But I feel like, yeah, Top Model was a huge success. But once again, I think the thing with Top Model was, it wasn't, even though I created it, co-created it, it wasn't mine. You know, it wasn't something that my voice, it wasn't, you know, the nature of reality is reverse engineering storytelling. You know what I'm saying? Which is something I'm really glad that I learned, a skill I learned, but it wasn't the same thing as actually creating story. You know, it was creating story in some time in a little bit of a duplicitous way, you know. So it was an interesting diversion, but I really feel like, I mean, I've always wanted to be a teacher. My wife at that time had become a doctor, so she was making a good living. I think that might have been something I would have went into. You know what I'm saying? I've always liked to sort of explain to people the things that I've learned in a way that, and show them from a way that not a lot of people got to see, you know. So I might have done something like that, but I've never been asked that question. But, you know, it's a interesting, you know, alternative history that I really would wonder what would happen.
Well, in a way, of course, I think you still got to be a teacher with a lot of these episodes that you did on Black-ish or with Black-ish, and, you know, the ones that always get talked about, but I think for good reason. Season 2, episode 16, Hope, about police brutality, which you've said you had, quote, never been that afraid to turn a script in, close quote. Season 4, episode 1, Juneteenth, which we've talked a little bit about. But I think one of the big moments in your life and career, it seems, is that you got to really, through this work, get the attention of somebody who sounds like you've always really admired and who now is your biggest fan and who we've had on this podcast, and that is Mr. Norman Lear. And, you know, people like to sort of reflexively say, oh, Black-ish is the the modern day Cosby Show, but I think the way you've talked about it, it's actually more the modern day Good Times. And that was a show of his that you were very familiar with, right? So I guess can you talk about Norman Lear and the role he's, you know, come into your life, and you even had him in your writer's room at one point?
Yeah, he played much more of a role in my life than Bill Cosby did. You know what I'm saying? I think the Cosby Show was amazing. I know that Bill Cosby is done horrendous things, you know what I'm saying? And it's sort of hard sometimes because I see that, like, they've taken off the air, you know, and things like that. But the show, I argue sometimes because I feel like, where do we separate art from artist, you know? And if we're not going to do that, do we go close the museums? Because the museums are full of beautiful things made by ugly people, you know? But that show was, it changed a lot, you know what I'm saying? Changed a lot of things for a lot of people. But the thing about the Cosby Show was it could have basically been a white family. You know what I'm saying? And that was what Bill felt like he needed to do for that time. But that was the first time that I saw, like, my white friends want to have the same dad that I wanted to have. I was like, you want Cliff to be your dad too? Oh my God. So it was a great thing for a lot of, you know, people, and brought us closer, and it gave, you know, was aspirational for a lot of little black kids and white kids. But Norman Lear, I would say this, you know, Black is All in the Family meets Good Times, you know what I'm saying? In some aspects, just really being honest and true to things and saying things that were sort of a part of the zeitgeist that people may not hear on television, you know. And Norman continued to every, you know, I just went to the, God, I love Norman. I need to call him. I just went to the live taping, you know, last year, I think, of All in the Family that he and Kimmel did. And it was shocking. You know, I leaned over to Norman. I was like, you could have changed some words and written this yesterday. And it's amazing that's how little we've grown in terms of television writing. You know what I'm saying? It was like all of a sudden, this was a guy who had multiple hits. You know what I'm saying? It's legitimate, solid, monster shows on television. And then all of a sudden, because selling soap and the bureaucracy of television became such a thing, we all of a sudden weren't talking about things anymore. And I love Marta Kaufman. She's we've become friendly, and she's become someone I really admire. And I saw recently, and it really made me love her even more. She regretted, you know, the lack of diversity on Friends, you know what I'm saying? And which is one of the greatest shows ever. But I remember looking at Friends and saying, what part of New York is this exactly? Like, there is not even a Puerto Rican waitress. Like, you know, the notion of, but that was not something that she wasn't doing purposely, but you didn't have to seek that out. You didn't have to seek out diversity. So when we did Black-ish, it was more in the tradition of Norman Lear. Like, it wasn't, Cosby Show was a family that happened to be Black. You know what I'm saying? Black-ish was a family that was absolutely Black. And every week it was about, you know, because you live in your Blackness. You live in your, if you're Irish, you live in your Irishness. If you're Italian, you live in your Italianness. And so the idea of, like, not having a family that lives in their skin and lives in their being and lives in that place every day, it was weird to me. So I was like, let's have a show about that, but also let's have a show that reflects that there are strides being made. You know what I'm saying? My wife's a doctor. I'm a writer. This, you know, Rainbow on television's a doctor, and Dre's an ad executive. There are strides being made. And the little kids that I have and that I see around my kids don't look like the little black kids I remember growing up. And I was like, let's talk about, even though you're taught to give your kids more than you had, what do you lose in the process? And that was sort of the conceit and the spine of what Black-ish was.
You mentioned Dave Chappelle earlier, and I wanted to ask you if you ever could relate to something that he's talked about where he, you know, achieved this great success with Chappelle's Show and then walked away from a lot of money to keep doing it because, in his mind, white audiences were not hearing the jokes necessarily. They were sort of, he might do jokes about the black community that he wanted people to laugh with, white people to laugh with, but they were laughing at, you know what I mean? More than, It seemed like that was the issue that caused him a lot of concern. And I guess he's gotten past it because we're now seeing him back at work, thank goodness. But was that ever something that you had to think about where it's like, because you're playing to both audiences with Black-ish, it's not a put in a box show where this is a black show, yeah, or this is a white show. Did you ever worry about, you know, I guess the phrase, I'm trying to remember what people say. It's like code switching when they talk about,
no,
you know, and
not one day, honestly, yeah, not one day on that show. I think good. That, and we, I learned really early on because I'd had so many failed pilots that this show was probably not going to make it. And so I was like, if it's not going to make it, because shows don't make it, it's not going to make it on my terms. And Vicky Dummer, who I love, who's the head of, you know, head of ABC Curb right now, and is just an amazing executive, we'd get notes. And I had a moment I started, and I tease her about it today, whenever they'd push back with notes, because it was such a different show they had done before, I would say, well, you know, culturally speaking, I don't think, and they'd be like, yeah, you're right, culturally speaking, you're probably. And it became sort of like a little dog whistle to the idea of like, guys, let me do this. You know what I'm saying? I can, it's going to work or not. And if you want to cancel it, cancel it. But it was, they ended up letting me have a lot of freedom on that show. And I still look back, you know, at Lemons and Juneteenth and Hope and the N Word and just like some of these episodes that we were able to do. I'm like, how the fuck did we get, excuse me, how did we get away with doing this? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I think it was because it was such a unique show at that time that I think a lot of things actually became derivative of in some aspects in a good way. It was such a unique show at that time, and ABC had stumbled into something, and we kind of all realized it at the same time, that they really gave us a lot of freedom, you know, and they were very, very, some of the, you know, best executives in terms of allowing that show to have its voice that I think I could have worked with.
And I know just for people wondering who the executives, you know, the main players were, it was, as you mentioned, Paul Lee, until I think it was maybe season two when Channing Dungey comes in and becomes the first black female.
Season three.
Uh-huh. Yeah, first black female to lead a network. Did that in any way impact what you were doing, or it was just a thing that was going on in the background?
No, Channing was always very supportive. You know what I'm saying? She had the unfortunate job of having to come talk to me about an episode that I didn't get to air. Yes. You know, and she did it with the most humanity I've ever seen an executive. You know, she had tears in her eyes when she talked to me, her and Vicky Dummer, about the episode. You know, she was very always an advocate. Paul had set the show up in such a, Channing might have actually came season four, but Channing was such an advocate of the show. You know, the studio, who was ran at the time by Patrick Moran, and Amy Harcourt was our studio executive, was beyond supportive. You know what I'm saying? They argued and they were scared because they're the bank. You know what I'm saying? But we were getting a lot of critical acclaim, even from shows that had higher ratings from us. And critical acclaim can give you a lot of guards, you know, and put some guardrails up for us. And so we knew that we were probably going to be around. We had Tracy, Anthony, and Lawrence, who were in those amazing kids. And we felt like, you know, sometimes things like that happen and, you know, and you're in a great place. So we had a really supportive studio. You know, Bob Iger, who I think, you know, I joke that he was made in a CEO factory. Like, he's, hi, I'm Bob Iger, reading for the role of CEO, because he's such the perfect CEO. Like, could not have been more supportive and understanding and behind the show, the personal letters, the personal calls, personal notes, the stop bys, you know, the heralding the show in the way that he did. So from the very top to the bottom, the only person that I never really gelled with at that place was Ben Sherwood, you know, right. And that's the one of the only people that I really to this day feel like I don't care about that guy. You know what I'm saying? Like he comes off to me as he was a bully. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? He was a bully who got in the news and then somehow stumbled his way up in white man world into a position that he was not in any way suited for.
So. And, you know, I'm certainly not going to harp on this point because I know we're going to come to in just one moment to Black AF, which is whole new chapter of your life. But I think to discuss how one led to the other, I just have to at least ask you if you can share, you know, people know the broad outlines that there was this episode that you just referred to, Please Baby Please, which ABC financed, it gets made. It's so there was clearly at one point an intention to do something with it. It wouldn't have gotten that far in the process. But what was it about, and why didn't it, from your perspective, why didn't it go on the air and cause and why did it cause what it seems like was the final straw in your relationship with that network?
I think we had creative differences. I can say that. You know what I'm saying? I think there were creative differences. I think it was a really different time in society. You know what I'm saying? I think there was a lot of things happening within the company. I think that we, you know, in the best way possible, decided to, you know, the changes that needed to be what needed to be made for it in order for it to be on air was not something that we could come to, you know, an agreement on, and we decided to part ways in the most amicable way humanly possible. You know, and you know, I think the things behind it, like there is no version of Bob Iger being a racist at all. You know what I'm saying? He's the most, you know, could not be further from that in terms of my dealings with him. There was no, you know, I had no negative feelings about ABC as a studio, you know, at all. I still remain very, very close and still have a really good relationship with most of those people there. It just was, you know, the times, and which actually speak to the times we're in now.
Just so people know what we're talking about here, I mean, it was basically, and please correct me if this is wrong, but my understanding was an episode that was going to sort of be a bedtime story that was going to be getting into what our times are actually like, which at that moment there was going to be a little bit about Trump and Charlottesville and NFL kneeling and all of that. And so at a time when ABC was, or Disney was in the process of trying to acquire Fox, it might have been a thought of theirs or Ben Sherwood or whoever that we can't do this now because this could jeopardize our ability to complete that deal. Do you believe that that was their reason for preventing that from going on the air?
I don't know.
When did you become shy? I thought you
were... I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like, you know, I still have hope. I talked to Dana Walden and Bob Iger and Peter Rice. I still have hope that that show, that episode is actually going to air.
Oh, you know, that'd be amazing.
It's closer to airing now than it ever has been. And I think that it would be something that I would love to really show in a way that we haven't shown before, you know what I'm saying, what it meant, you know, to me and to what I think we were, the message we were trying to convey.
That would be amazing. Well, okay, so you now, it's August 2018, and you are a free agent, and you get offers from at least two pretty great places, Warner Brothers, which I think offers more, and then Netflix. Why'd you go to Netflix?
How did you know that?
Well, because I've, you know, done my homework. Come on.
Where's that listed at?
Is it wrong?
I don't know, but that's a very, I've never heard someone mention that back to me. So it's interesting, just saying.
All right. Well, so why'd you go with Netflix, and what is the, it's got to be a pretty different experience to go from having to make 24 episodes, factoring in commercials, factoring in, you know, what you can say and do.
Let me be very clear. If that was the case, if those places were the case, the reason that I am in love with Peter Roth, you know what I'm saying? Like literally, I think that he is an old school studio boss, like from a better year, you know what I'm saying? And he gets it in a way that I don't see a lot of, you know, guys getting it. And he is a class act, like the classiest of class act. And I feel like that would have been a very, if that were to happen, that would have been a very, 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 very difficult decision for me to make. The only reason that I would have made that decision was because Netflix would have been a place where I was not going to be developing, but making, you know what I'm saying? And I was coming out of
No pilots,
you know what I'm saying? And I'm coming out of a system where I wouldn't have to go pitch, you know what I'm saying, to networks and through the, you know, that I could go actually go make things. And that would have been the, you know, I had just done a pilot with Courtney B. Vance and Felicity Huffman about a black liberal married to a white conservative. And they had a show, and it was about like literally talking about, and it would have been a monster show. Like seriously, like you talk, they used to have that thing where they showed failed pilots. We did four reshoots on it. I knew it was going a ding. I had been beyond frustrated with the process of things not going. And I had done a few other pilots and things that went. And so the notion of, I think that frustration would have been the only thing that if I would have been the case that would have kept me from, not from Peter Roth or Warner Brothers, because that's still my family, but it was the opportunity to go make things, which Netflix absolutely has stayed true to their word, to go make things and to, it's not really notes, it's thoughts that they give, you know, and the interesting thing about when you get thoughts and don't, you know, not notes is, okay, go do what you want to do, but, you know, we'll cancel you first season. They're a big first season canceling place, you know what I'm saying? And so you can literally offer your own demise there. So it's scary, but, you know, you also can go make the big catch, you know, in the big game. So it was, they have lived very much up to their word in a way that I cannot speak more highly of, and it's been a great situation. But I do love Peter Roth. I do love what they do. And I do feel like it, I miss network television sometimes. I just recently, you know, they showed Hope in Juneteenth, you know, during the protests. And I was like, the idea of being able to speak on a weekly basis to audiences with the amount of sort of like prescience, like, you know, like we're right here, we're speaking to you about what's going on, topical nature. That's something that I do sort of miss, you know, because there is some time about the bundling thing. You can try and make them, but depending on how quickly you're able to get it out, sometimes it's not as on point as you'd like it to be, especially when you like to talk about things. But I, you know, I do enjoy it.
So last couple of minutes here, I just want to obviously hone in on this first season of Black AF, where did you, is this something you'd always wanted to, a story you'd always wanted to tell, but because of, you know, the sort of network standards and practices and things, you couldn't,
100%.
You couldn't, yeah?
100%, so yeah. Yeah, the idea that people criticize me for it being so close to Black-ish, I'm like, oh, fuck yourself, dude. Like, I would do it, I would do it again. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, writers tell their stories in their voices. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin's one of my favorite writers. And he, how many times have you told a version of the same Aaron Sorkin story? You know what I'm saying? Woody Allen, how many times have you turned to, you know, so I, you know, I know you're not supposed to say Woody Allen anymore, I guess, but whatever the case may be. But, you know, the writers that we love, you know what I'm saying, they tell versions of their story. And I feel like this was a version of my story that I think as much shit as I took now, it's like, yeah, every episode was named because of slavery. You know what I'm saying? Twitter. You know what I'm saying? Now, do you understand what I was talking about? Yeah, I did another Juneteenth episode. Twitter. Critics, do you understand why I did it? You know what I'm saying? Like, the notion of, like, the idea of trying to tell that story is important to tell over and over and over again, because it's needs to get hammered into the idea that we're a part of this fabric of this country in a way that you're not seeing.
Would it have been, because I can hear, you know, what you're saying. And I'm wondering, do you think it might have people, some of the people that gave it a hard time, would they have maybe had a different response if it had dropped last week instead of 2 months ago?
Of course. You know what I'm saying? Everybody has something to say. You know what I'm saying? Look, the show was not perfect. You know what I'm saying? I feel like I'm a crappy actor. You know what I'm saying? I got better, but I feel like some of that crappy acting actually helped the role. And a true actor couldn't have played that role. It would not have been the same show. You know what I'm saying? Wouldn't have been as loud. Wouldn't have been as noisy. It would have been, isn't there an actor already playing you on a show? You know, there were, everything was thought out. I feel like for the most part, it was, I think, the most talked about comedy maybe in Twitter, on Twitter, period. You know what I'm saying? In terms of the hashtag, I would not do anything different. I feel like I have never seen, because there's so few Black creators, you know what I'm saying, that get to do this, we are often at the mercy of social media and critics, because our stories don't get viewed in a completely different way. It's, you know, it's three of us telling a story for, you know, 1,000 different archetypes, you know what I'm saying? And so it's like, you can only, you know, pick, only so many people are going to get your story. And I feel like all the people who sort of like, you know, criticize, you know, this or the color of this, and didn't know it was based on my family, and didn't know my wife was biracial, and didn't understand that because of slavery, that I'm saying that there's generational trauma that affects our things and talks. And I'm doing another Juneteenth episode because I want Juneteenth to eventually become a national holiday, and I want to talk about it as much as I can. I'm talking about criticism, how it's important. The idea of the things, and talking about dysfunction, I'm showing it. You know, that my life has grown from where I started Black-ish to where it is now, and that's an important aspirational thing for people to be able to see a different lane. I feel like I definitely, you know, say that I want to, there's been a part of me that wants to go, and I've said this in a few interviews, I want to go start doing a weekly column op-ed called I Got Time Today, where I start reviewing reviewers. You know what I'm saying? And I start digging into their IGs and looking at their reviews and the shit that they missed, and say, you know, because I feel like our words are powerful. And yeah, you know, as a writer, you know what I'm saying, that there's a responsibility that goes to every one of those words. And I feel like, you know, when you jump on and don't see things, I saw something recently in my publicist, it gets mad every time I bring this up, but there were four Black critics that had reviewed my show, you know what I'm saying, did not like the show, which is fine. I totally am cool with that. But they chose to get together
another
round table about it. And I'm like, what the fuck is that, dude? Like, you know what I'm saying? You guys all individually didn't like it. Now you're going to get together and talk about it on Black Tuesday? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is your contribution to Black Tuesdays. You're going to release this tearing down a show that has so many different layers that you're not, haven't even looked at, because you think that this is your job to once again, you know, this, what are you getting from this, nerd? You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like it, the notion of that would never happen with an, you know what I'm saying, with a white show. You know what I'm saying? The idea that these, you know, that sometime I feel like that is the responsibility that's put upon us, and I accept it fully. And I totally, there were some reviews that weren't great. There were a lot of good reviews, but there were some reviews that weren't great. And I, some of them I really appreciated. You know what I'm saying? I didn't appreciate the think pieces. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, why does this show need a think piece? It's a comedy. You need 7 pages to do a think piece on my show. You know, I, some of the reviews that, you know, didn't, I, and some of the reviews that I, my greatest story is I had read a review from The Atlantic, a think piece from The Atlantic, which was like my magazine, which I love. And as I'm, you know, sick, you know, closing, because they tell me things I missed in Black AF. I'm like, how do you know what I missed, Atlantic? But as I'm closing the laptop, I get a text from Malcolm Gladwell, who's like The Atlantic and my God, you know what I'm saying? Like in terms of, and he was very, very complimentary of the show and saying really nice things. And, you know, so I think that that is the nature of, I am one of those people who read reviews. So if reviewers want to fuck with me, they can. You know what I'm saying? Because
they might get an email from you, though.
Yes, they might get. I won't. My publicist won't let me send an email, but I want to. I want to every time. I really do. I really want to. Like, I love these moments where I get to actually call them out. You know what I'm saying? Because I do care. You know what I'm saying? I do. I'm not one of those kind of people who I'm like, I don't care. I'm not going to play that game. I care.
Well, to that end, this will be my last question, but a two-parter, if it's okay.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy acting? Is it something that you would want to keep doing? Has it, you know, has it affected the way you think about writing? That's part A. And then part B, have these criticisms that you're talking about made you more or less interested in continuing with Black AF? Is it going to affect the path that you go forward with?
Absolutely, positively, acting was the scariest thing I've ever did. You know what I'm saying? It literally, I had loose stomach, you know what I'm saying, for most of the time. I gained such a respect for what they do. You know what I'm saying? The idea of having a 5K camera put on you, and no matter what day you're having, no matter what argument you're having, having to get in, hide your emotions and try to, you know, that. So it's what they do is magic. I do not think that I would act again beyond this show. Maybe I would do commercials or marriage or something, but I think that this is the thing for me. You know what I'm saying? This is not a career that I wanted to get into. This is something thing for me. And I've had some offers, but I, you know what I'm saying? I honestly feel like this is the thing that I really enjoy doing, and it was special for me to do it for this. In terms of the polarizing nature of the show, I feel like the reason this show should get an Emmy, and I've never cared, and I've never said this before, is because about anything I've done, is because that's what art is. And I feel like the idea of there's not another show right now that you can look back, especially what we're going through. We talked about this. All these things, you know what I'm saying, that we shot a year, or like, these are things that we talked about, you know, and the idea that Black-ish never was awarded it because the cool cable shows were taking it. This is the cool cable show. You know what I'm saying? I feel like that we talked about this and during a time when everyone almost got to see it real time. And the polarizing nature of it is basically what I think most shows should be. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to ever do anything again that's not polarizing. Because the way that you actually get people to talk is you have to have different points of view.
But is this particular conversation over, or are you going to keep it going?
Oh, I'm going to do it again.
So season two is coming.
We'll see. But I mean, if it's allowed to come, I'm doing it again.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I always have really enjoyed your stuff, and I so appreciate you doing this.
Appreciate you, dog.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporters Podcast Network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, K. Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's series regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.